Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, even with our somewhat depleted numbers. Yeah, I have no small amount of Schadenfreude looking back east and seeing what the weather's like, and you know, walking out here. It's just truly a, it is truly a wonderful word and a feeling to have. So you're going to ask me to talk about some stuff, and I kind of dithered about what I was going to talk about, and I said all the stuff that I'm doing more interested in now, as opposed to the older work I was thinking about talking about. And this has to do partly with some of the stuff that Emma was talking about last week. Not quite. It's that the issues are somewhat different. The questions being asked are somewhat different, but there are threads that sort of intertwine here. And it has to do with the question of how do we really set the initial state for inflation, or how should it get set? What things are we supposed to be careful about when we talk about, say, computing the power spectrum, computing non-Gaussianities, et cetera, the things that people want to do now in inflation? What should we really be being careful about with this? And this is work I've been doing for quite some time now with my collaborator, Hale Collins, who's at Niels Bohr Institute right now. So why are we doing this? So at some level, so the first difference with Emil's talk is that I don't care about dark energy. Dark energy is too hard. It's just too hard. Inflation, on the other hand, seems to be accessible to some calculations. And this is these are the pictures from the latest WMAP 5 release. And every day that passes, inflation becomes more and more the thing that appears to be happening out there. It really, the anti-correlation, sort of the rise in the TT power spectrum here and the falling off of the TE power spectrum there, these are super horizon scales. That's touted usually as the smoking gun for something like inflation to have happened. So the error bars did in fact get smaller from WMAP 3. It really appears like something like inflation did go on. So what we want to do, you know, various people have various things they'd like to do with inflationary data. One of the things we'd like to do is to be able to extract at least some constraints on what physics might be driving inflation. So in particular, the usual thing people talk about constraining is the inflaton potential. So that's the standard thing you care about. What I'm going to try to bring up later is that that's not really enough. You should be asking for more. The odds are not so clear whether you'll get more, but you certainly should be asking for more. And here you see the pictures. Again, these are from the Komatsu et al. Paper on implications for inflation from the WMAP 5 release. And you see the standard pictures now where they're in the R, which is the amplitude of the tensor to scalar power spectra versus the spectral index. In these pictures, these are the various confidence intervals, and you start to see that some models really are getting are significantly out of favor. So in fact, the standard thing that Andre Linde used to love so much, like chaotic inflation, really now are getting excluded. Okay, except for maybe if Mark tells me that with putting some cosmic string in there might make a difference, and that's a different story. I don't believe that when they worked this out, they included any cosmic string admixture.
So you can barely see that slide. Well, what is it that's being ruled out, and why?
So this is chaotic inflation. This is lambda phi fourth, m squared phi squared inflation, m squared phi squared, which is when you have n fields, each running a little bit towards, you know, making up the distance to the Planck scale. And this is the Harrison-Sildovich point. And so this is, 95% confidence levels. And you're plotting R.
This is the constraint on the power spectrum.
Coming from the power
spectrum.
Right. Exactly. And so this is chaotic inflation. This is basically power law inflation, where you have a parameter P. It looks exponential, but with this parameter P, as you dial it up, you get power law inflation. And then hybrid inflation, you get constraints on that as well. So you certainly can put constraints on the potentials here, given certain assumptions that are worth talking about, and which we'll come to in just a second. And
one question. I mean, if you say lambda phi to the 4th, you assume lambda phi to the 4th without an m squared, right?
Right.
And suppose you would take m squared phi squared plus lambda phi to the fourth and give the lambda some value, would that change then the...
Probably change it slightly, but I don't think it would change these contours very much.
And you really have to fine-tune to get both of those to be significant.
To be significant and give you enough inflation.
Apparently you expect one of them to completely dominate.
Right.
When the CMB is
and that's going to be sort of dependent on, you know, that'll depend on sort of where you start your initial conditions for one thing. You know, if the phi fourth part's already dominant versus the phi squared piece, that's going to be different as opposed to if you started a little bit lower. So from that perspective, you're not going to learn a whole lot more from that. Okay, and here are other parameters that they try to constrain. Here is the running of the spectral index and so forth. So they cannot, you know, the data are really, really good. They're getting better. I guess they're trying to get money for a WMAP 9 release at some point. But in all of this, if we're putting constraints on things, the first question we really should ask is how reliable are these calculations? What are the inputs that really go into these calculations? And can we quantify in any sense how reliable those inputs might be? So that's what I want to talk about. And to do that, it's worth asking just how do we compute things? So the picture usually is that we start, so we're deep inside the inflationary horizon. There's some quantum fluctuation of the inflaton field that's within that horizon. Then it gets stretched by the expansion of the universe until it leaves the horizon, and then eventually it left the horizon in the middle picture, and then eventually it comes back into the post-reheating or post-preheating FRW-like horizon. And at that point, it can start moving matter around. It can start making little gravitational wells for the CMB photons to fall in and out of. And that's how we get our picture of the WMAP pictures for the CMB. So that's the picture. So we have quantum fluctuations and then just redshifting of, this, of the scale, of the distance scale. So... okay, so quantum fluctuations. Like Emma was telling us last week, if we were doing this in flat space, there'd be really no issue here. We would there's a unique Poincaré invariant vacuum. You pick it. That's what you use to do your calculations. It's the obvious vacuum to pick, and you're done. In inflation, that's not quite so clear anymore because there is no a priori reason to pick one vacuum over another. You do have some symmetries, but even within the category of those symmetries, there are still some choices that you can pick. You can worry about the short distance singularities and so forth, but it's not totally obvious how to pick vacuum. And so what you typically do is you decompose your inflaton field into the zero mode piece, which is driving inflation and fluctuations around it, and then do the standard Fourier decomposition. These modes obey a wave equation. And when you solve it, you get your standard Hankel functions and so forth. And the question is, how do you pick those coefficients? How do you pick the strength of the Hankel function? So there's a partial answer. Just from getting equal time commutation relations gives you the overall normalization here in terms of the relative coefficient. Okay, so this I'm going to keep using this fk here. I'll call this the structure function and what goes on after this. But we still have to, you know, we still have ambiguities in here. We still have the structure function as an ambiguity that we have to sort out. So how do we do that? All right. So if we were in strict de Sitter, we could make use of the symmetries. I want to sort of make a different, the standard argument, but I want to say it a little bit differently to match up with what I'll talk about later. So the standard statement is that, well, okay. If I go to short distance, if I go to short distance early times, space-time should look flat. And the field should not notice that space-time is not flat. So make the field notice that space-time, believe that space-time is flat by imposing boundary conditions so that you choose the relative coefficients in that linear combination so that you match to the flat space vacuum at very early times. Okay? And, you know, from sort of principle of equivalence kind of statement and so forth, it's not, you know, it's not an unreasonable statement to make. If you go to very short distance, things should look like flat space, okay? And if you make use of that argument, you pick out one of the two modes, and that's what we usually call the bunch Davy state. Okay, so that's one way. That's not the symmetry way to access the bunch Davy state, but it is a way to make the argument that that's the state that should be preferred if you're going to start calculating fluctuations. All right. On the other hand, you might be a little bit concerned. I mean, there is this matching at very deep in the very deep ultraviolet that you have to do to make this argument. Suppose there's new physics. Suppose something happens. Suppose there's some scale M past which something happens to the inflaton, the wave equation gets modified drastically. Heck, maybe the inflaton's composite after a certain scale. The physics is completely different. Right? Then it's not so clear that this is the right way to pick the vacuum or state. Let me not call it a vacuum. Okay? It's not so clear that this is the correct way to do things. And in fact, you know, so how do you deal with that?
But you can also change the metric if you think of some new physics.
Oh, sure. I'm you know, little steps for little people for me, right? So I'm just assuming, pretend it's all FRW. It's all, even all de Sitter. Let's give it that much. But let me just say that all of a sudden new physics shows up. Keep the metric, you know, still at least within the category of FRW. But certainly something just within the field theory could happen. Okay, let alone anything else. And in fact, I mean, so you might say, well, I could say maybe suppose the inflaton's composite. So maybe suppose it's not. Why give yourself the aggravation of worrying about these issues? So what I want to argue for you next is that at some level we really do have to worry about these issues. It's kind of there's no way to really escape this. And that goes by the name of the Trans-Plancken problem. I know I was talking to Chris Hill at FrameLab, and he certainly was talking about these things when I was a postdoc there back in the mid-80s. But I think it's been highlighted more recently, and certainly more forcefully by Brandenburger and various things, and Brandenburger and Martin in a number of papers. So what's the point? We need at least 60 to 65 E-folds to solve horizon flatness and monopole. That's just a given. Okay? And if you look at most models, it's actually keeping it to exactly 60 to 65 is actually quite a fine-tuning of things. If you get inflation at all, you tend to get quite a bit more inflation than just 60 to 65 E-folds. 100, 10,000, quite a bit more. So do the following exercise. Look at all the scales on the sky that you care about, the CMB sky. Look at all those scales. Redshift them back down to when you think an inflation may have started. What you find is that if you have any more than the bare minimum 60 to 65 E-folds, those scales are sub-Planckian in size. The distance scales are sub-Planckian. The energy scales are trans-Planckian. Okay? So pictorially, oh, I guess it went. All right. So pictorially, all those scales that started off large up here had to have started from somewhere, you know, deep, you know, very, very deep in the ultraviolet. So the question arises, you know, to do any of the calculations that we're talking about to understand the power spectrum or anything like that, do we have to know all of quantum gravity to be able to make that statement? And if so, that's a real worrisome statement, right? Because that's an amazingly huge violation of decoupling. Because we're looking at the CMB, which you could argue is the observable on the largest distance scales, and arguing that the physics at the shortest distance scales won't decouple from it. Okay, I need to know all of that physics to make a statement. Now, notice what I am saying here, just to sort of alleviate that statement somewhat. All I've done is I've done the scaling of distance scales. It could be somehow, as if by magic, that the physics doesn't change, that somehow it's there's no new physics evolves up from the Planck scale and imprints itself on those on the CMB sky. Okay? So that could happen. But if it does happen, you have to understand why. I mean, that's not an accident. That's something major that you have to deal with. Okay? So that's the Trans-Plancken problem. Now, especially around these parts, if you had clouds, they surely would have a silver lining. Same set of words up to here that we have to be at these sub-Planckian scales. But there's a flip side, right? It's an opportunity. If the physics really does imprint itself from short distance to large distance like this, then, you know, they canceled funding for the ILC. Fine. I'll just build better and better CMB detectors. Because all that physics is up there somewhere. If I'm really clever, if I do polarization experiments, et cetera, if I'm clever enough, I should be able to extract all that short distance physics that truly would be inaccessible to any accelerator we'd build out of looking at the CMB. So two facets of this issue, but the real point is the whole story about how to fix the vacuum state, how to initialize those all the momentum states. I can't escape that. I have to make some statement about what's going on in the vacuum or in the initial state. I have to be able to understand what's going on, make some statements about this.
I cannot check this number. If you take 1 degree in the sky now, mm-hmm. and then how far must you redshift? To what temperatures?
Well, I mean, so
it's one Planck scale.
It's about e to the 65. Take so 2 degrees Kelvin now, e to the 65 times 2 degrees Kelvin. So that's the bare minimum. So if you don't want, if things broke just right and you got 60 E folds, then you would just barely have to be concerned about these issues. I mean, probably actually more than barely, but you would have to have some level of concern with them. But if it's more than that, if it's 100 E folds, which is not, it's not even a factor of two from that, I really have to worry about it. Okay? All right. So just pictorially again, there is this regime where I'm going to have to say something about what goes on there. Either I say nothing new goes on there, and which is a decision I have to, I could make and just pretend I know that that's the case and go ahead and do my physics and see how it compares to what observation tells me, or I'm going to have to make some hopefully slightly more clever statement than that. Okay, so there is this Trans-Planckian issue to deal with, and people have been worrying about this for a while, and there are some ideas about how to deal with this. So, and there's two different categories of overarching paradigms about how to deal with this. The first is just build funny models, just string inspired, ultra string deeply inspired, things of that sort, and so you have modified dispersion relations, which is what Brandenburg and Martin came up with. There are modified uncertainty relations at short distances. Gary Hsu and various people came up with ideas like that. There are the alpha vacua that Emil came up with and sort of pretend that somehow those are, or some version of the alpha vacua of the Sitter space are the correct vacuum states to use and see what happens there. And something I did with Cliff Burgess and Jim Klein and his student Lemieux is to just to have a playground to understand these ideas a little bit with is just assume, say you have a hybrid inflation type model, but instead of just letting the inflaton roll down the trough, suppose that the cross field in that model starts off at a non-zero value and oscillates for a while. Okay, that actually feeds into the inflaton fluctuations and disturbs the state, but in a controlled sort of way. And you can actually see that you do get effects. I mean, you can... There is a region of parameter space where effects can show up in the CMB sky.
Rich, what is the prospects of doing this problem like an inverse scattering problem, where you take the data today, let the state be arbitrary, and then you try and figure out what the...
Why, oddly enough, that's exactly what I want to get to. I will get to that. So this is basically just throwing darts. You have an infinite board and you're throwing darts and you're hoping for something to happen, right? Presumably, I mean, when we did our throwing of darts, we learned something. That's not it. Oh yeah, this is it. Okay, so what do you learn from, say, the Brandenburg? From I guess this is actually one of these modified dispersion relations by Martin and Rangeval. So they picked a funny physics and they ran CMB fast with it. And what did they get? And this picture is bad, but what you may or may not be able to see is that the black line is their Trans-Planckian physics, and it's really hard to see because it's new physics. But there are little wiggles on top of what would have been the usual straight WMAP line. So there are little oscillations superimposed on the rise to the first peak in the WMAP data from these modified dispersion relations. So that would be one signal that you would try to look for.
Does this depend on having 65 e-foldings? Does this also hold for large numbers of
e-folds? If too many e-folds, you're going to wash this. You're going to wash everything away.
So that was also fine-tuned.
Oh, absolutely. The great thing about inflation from a fine-tuning perspective is that you have to fine-tune anyway to get the fluctuation spectrum to work out and so forth. And it's like being a little bit pregnant. Once you go that far, it's all good, right? So there's that level of fine-tuning. But the exercise here is just to see, suppose I had this new physics. How might it show up on the observables I'm interested in?
So generically, it would be much bigger and ruled out, or much smaller and...
So big.
They pick some parameters to make it interesting.
That's right. They pick some parameters to make it interesting. But what you can ask in that question is, parametrically, what do the effects depend on? Okay, and there have been big fights over that. And so let me see what we have here. Okay, so they tend. Figure of merit is H over M. And powers of H over M, where H is the Hubble parameter during inflation, and M is the scale of new physics, whatever that new physics may be. So either it's Planck scale physics or something in between happened, and so forth. But so there's been the big fight is what power of H over M shows up in these corrections. Because if it's H over M, you're going to be able to see it. If there are such corrections at all, H over M for the values of H that appear to be consistent with WMAP, you're going to be able to see those corrections, if not in WMAP 5, certainly with Planck or with some of the other surveys. Whereas H over M squared or higher powers, you're doomed. You will never see anything.
See, I came in just a little late, right? What is H and what is M?
So H is the Hubble parameter during inflation, and M is the scale of whatever new physics might show up in the inflationary, in inflationary physics. So in particular, it could just be the Planck scale. So you've blue shifted all your modes down to below the Planck scale. Some new physics shows up there, modifies the fluctuation modes, and then grows back out.
Joe? New physics means any physics that
modifies the modes, the inflaton modes
from
their Bunch Davies state to any others, to some different, to some linear combination of that.
I'm embarrassed to ask this, but what defined old physics?
Bunch Davies is old physics. Strict Bunch Davies is old physics. Anything not Bunch Davies is new physics.
Thank you.
Okay. Or anything that would induce modifications from Bunch Davies, I'll call that new physics. So, Joe?
That's good.
Okay. All right. So in particular, if in the alpha, the truncate, what we call the truncated alpha vacuum that Danielson used, there was indeed an H over M first power correction. This is the ordinary result from a standard Bunch Davies inflation, and here are these oscillations that superimpose themselves. Okay, and of course they're actually oscillations. I mean, if H were truly constant, if it were truly a cosmological constant, if H were constant, this is just some number. You would just use it to renormalize what you're seeing in the power spectrum. But the fact that you're in slow roll means that there's time dependence in there, and therefore K dependence, and therefore you could see this in the power spectrum.
So, I mean, this particular thing and many of these ideas seem to violate the adiabatic theorem.
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. And in fact, so the little model that Cliff and I had with the cross field and hybrid inflation oscillating while the inflaton was rolling, exactly why you could imprint stuff in there was a violation of the adiabatic theorem. Okay, so you can build models and you can learn that there could be corrections. You might be able to see something, but the questions that remain are sort of the obvious ones, right? To what extent do you have any kind of universal results that you could tell an experimentalist? You know, I'm not sure about the model, but you ought to be looking for this, okay, and not have them laugh. And then can different models be distinguished? All these models, they use a sort of a crude cutoff. They just slam a cutoff. I can't understand physics past here. But I'm kind of getting a little bit ahead of myself, but when we do effective field theory, that's not quite how we do that's not really how we work it. We don't really have a cutoff in our momentum integrals. What we really have is renormalization of coefficients. And so I want to talk about that a little bit next. But the moral of the story is that model building can give you helpful hints, but you really have to go a little bit beyond that.
What do you mean by we are used to integrating beyond the real genome of validity?
Well, I mean, you're used to, so if you have an effective field theory, you can still integrate your momentum from zero to infinity. You generate divergences.
So effective field theory with non-renormalizable operators.
Oh, absolutely. That's the effective field theory, right? I mean, effective field theory, I'm allowed to keep those operators as long as I don't ask questions that really require me knowing everything, but I require questions that have some finite size or finite energy resolution. So let's talk about that. So if we were just doing standard effective field theory, we would do the usual things. We'd use symmetries of the low energy theory. They fix the renormalizable operators. High energy physics shows up as stuff suppressed by M. Everything is consistent because at higher energy scales, all the new physics shows up suppressed by E over M. And in principle, to really make this renormalizable, I need an infinite number of operators. But in practice, I don't do infinitely precise measurements. So for any given measurement, for any given accuracy, I only need to keep a finite number of operators, and that will suffice to match to my data. Okay, so I'll do a finite number of measurements, pin down some coefficients, and then try to make predictions with what's left over. Okay, so that's what we do in the standard flat space case. In an expanding universe, of course, Emil brought this up, we've talked about this before, but the separation of scales is now non-trivial because of this redshifting of UV modes into the IR. So what you mean by M and so forth, you have to try to understand. And because of that, the questions that you wind up asking are time-dependent questions, and they're not the standard S matrix ones where I prepare a state in the infinite past and I look in the infinite future. What I really want to understand is time step by time step evolution of some of these observables. So I'm really looking not so much at in-out matrix elements, but at in-in ones. But that's what this workshop's all about. We know how to compute those. We use Schwinger-Keldysh methods, and we can compute those in-in matrix elements. It's a little bit harder than, it's no harder than the standard one. It's just, you just have to include all the correct degrees of freedom. So so you have an initial value problem now. You specify things at some initial time hypersurface, and usually you would just specify the values of the inflaton zero mode and the fluctuations. You have to, I don't want to say this. Let me come up to here for a second. The fact that we have this redshifting means that we have an earliest time. If we believe that we have a scale of physics that past which we don't understand what was going on, there's an earliest time in the theory. That's the time when I take, and it's an earliest time that's correlated with sort of the latest time that I'm worrying about. So what's the procedure? I look at the CMB sky today. I decide these are the scales I care about. I redshift them back down until I hit the scale M. And at that time, that's the earliest time that I can start talking about physics knowledgeably. Past that, I don't understand what's going on. That is the limit of validity of my effective field theory. Okay? And so I do need, so it does depend on this, on the scales that I'm interested in. If I were interested in a larger or smaller set of scales, this time would change. Okay? So what I want to do then is I want a formalism that takes this time into account, allows for perturbatively controlled calculations of all the cosmological interesting quantities. And the thing that I'm going to incorporate that's a little bit different than what's usually done is not only am I going to allow for the Lagrangian to have terms that are suppressed by powers of M, I'm going to go back into the initial state and modify it as well because it's part of the initial value problem. I have to understand what's going on at that state, and I can't understand it. I can only understand it modulo quantities that damp out as M goes to infinity. Okay, so has that set of words been relatively clear? Because
is the M beyond the Planck?
No. So certainly I certainly don't understand physics beyond the Planck scale. So I'm going to cut. M is certainly no larger than the Planck scale, but it could be less. There could be new physics happening into the inflaton field at lesser scales.
I was just trying to connect this with your earlier words about
transplanting. The transplanting. Well, so all I really so. if you believe in the model builders, they would say that they're really sampling stringy physics at the shortest distance scale and so forth. But all I really wanted to make use of that for is to say that there is some new physics that will inevitably have to be dealt with. And it's either at the Planck scale or at some scale lesser than that. Okay?
He just puts a UV cutoff, if you like, and then puts, operators, high-dimensional operators or whatever, to mimic the physics beyond this UV cutoff.
Right, right. So, let's start talking about this. There is an important point that, bring it up. If you look at, there are a number of ways, a number of people working on this, and one of them, for example, Danielson, when he did his calculations, and other people like Will Kenning, what they do is they say the following, that you have your scale M, it be at the Planck scale or what have you, and what they say is that the modes don't exist, truly do not exist in any real form until after the given momentum scale has crossed that new physics scale. Okay? So they're essentially saying that as each mode crosses, in Planck here, but as whatever the new physics scale is, that's when I define the modes. So that means I kind of have a time-dependent K of T depending on when a particular K crosses the Planck scale or whatever the new physics scale is. So, and you get some, and so you get some, you get this oscillating behavior coming out of that typically. We aren't doing that because that to us violates the spirit of effective field theory. I mean, if you're really doing effective field theory, here's a time past which, if I redshift my stuff beyond that, I'm going to come to an energy regime where I do not understand the physics. Okay? And that's where all these modes are sort of being sourced. And so he calls it the grid, something makes these modes just appear out of thin air, so to speak. But we're not going to say that. So we don't know the physics that's going on there. We truly do not know it. But we start things right here. There's some initial time, and that's when we start our physics. We define all our modes at once at that initial time. Okay? So that there really is a difference, and the results are different. The answers that you get, sort of the behavior of the power spectrum, is different. So at some level, if you could do things finely enough, you could actually use measurements of the power spectrum or, for example, of non-Gaussianities to actually distinguish between these two approaches. But, that's in the far
future. Wouldn't one be able to mimic the other depending on what conditions you impose at those hectares? I mean, when you say you impose conditions at a given time,
right,
all but one of your modes is larger than
right,
Planck scale at that time. And so you could just take the effective field theory equations and evolve it backwards, with that or not, to mimic whatever they say it is.
Sure. But, again, if I evolve it back, I would still have to believe that I could probe into that regime, right?
Right, so you may not think that physics is valid, but I'm just saying, you say you can distinguish.
Sure, yes, okay, fair enough. Fair enough. But I would,
And there's another problem, which is that if you put a time-dependent cutoff on the time dependence and the co-moving,
K,
then you'll generally produce a non-conserved energy momentum.
Yeah,
mass.
Yeah.
So, energy just coming from nowhere and appearing at that.
Right. Which basically means that in any number of levels, you're violating something, and you're certainly violating what you mean by effective field theory. Okay? You could argue that there's a deeper...
It makes sense of that prescription in a covariant.
But yet in that part of the community, that's the one they really love. I don't understand that either. So in essence, what they're doing is setting conditions on a time-like surface over here, as opposed to a space-like one where you would actually have a well-defined initial value problem. Okay, which is what we do.
Are you going to assume homogeneous entropy?
Yeah, for now. There's nothing in this that prevents me from adding more generality, other than the fact that things get hard and I can't make any predictions. Just because I can't calculate hard enough. But in principle, I could just take a more general metric, background metric, and work from that, and everything. I could do everything the same way.
Some sort of matter chauvinism.
Yeah, but I could do something like that. There's nothing. Basically, here I'm just trying to make contact with what the inflationary people do, where you basically assume that. And if you think about it, once inflation's kicked in, you know, very quickly everything goes away. So, although you could imagine changing the modes, that by changing the mode sufficiently, that say vorticity and so forth might actually feed itself into the mode behavior later on. So it's not, you know.
Well, it would be ironed out fairly quickly.
Right, but there might be, if you don't have too many E folds of inflation, you might imagine some sort of transient that that still shows up on some scales. Okay, so, all right, so what we want to do is construct something, construct a formalism that I can calculate to whatever order and extract physical predictions out of. And so the things that we're looking at are the power spectrum, non-Gaussianity, et cetera. With the new initial conditions, I mean, I have to modify the propagators to act, because what I'm doing now is choosing initial conditions that don't match up with the bunch Davies one, so that the initial time derivative of the modes is not just minus I omega k times the mode itself at the initial time. I'm allowing the omega, for example, to be very different from the omega that shows up in the equations of motion. Okay? And so I have to modify the propagators to incorporate that. And one way to understand what you do is basically you have this boundary surface at eta naught or t naught, and you've got conditions that you're setting up there. So you can imagine that you're really just doing a method of images type problem to choose propagators in just such a way, choose the Green's function in just such a way as to make the as to put the correct initial conditions on that boundary. And so we do that. That's this picture here. And you have the four propagators of the Schringer-Keldysh formalism, and they're the standard ones, but there's a modification in each one, this little piece over here, due to the fact that we're now allowing for non-trivial deviations from the original boundary conditions, original initial conditions. Okay, so these are the things I'm going to use to calculate. These modes, these U's, are the standard Bunch-Davies modes, but now I've got new pieces. Okay, so if this is going to work, it's got to work something like this. It's got to work so that if I'm going to do renormalization, the renormalization sort of away from that initial time boundary has to be the standard one. It has to be the standard set of counterterms that I would need and so forth. I don't want to mess that up.
But good question. If you say there are new higher canonical dimension operators or whatever, you're staying within a Gaussian approximation, right?
Yeah, at this point.
These mode functions, and I mean, so you leave out a whole bunch of possible conditions having, you know, non-trivial correlations.
Right. I'm being fully Gaussian. Right. So I'm not. So whatever non-Gaussianities develops in this particular version of things develops because of interactions, you know, with the gravitational field, what have you.
I don't put initial
non-Gaussian.
Huge class of possible.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And you do have. And again, this will be the appeal to higher authority argument that everybody else does it, where they assume. That you have zero initial non-Gaussianity. But a priori, it could be there. I'd have to argue about where it came from and why it didn't get washed out or what have you. But it certainly, that would be the much more general case, and then I would have to modify the initial conditions in the modes to deal with that. And, you know, so all I can say is at this point, we have not done that. Okay? So let me look. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to, what was I saying? You derailed my train of thought there. All right. So if you want to think about it in terms of bulk and boundary, in the bulk, the counterterms should be the standard counterterms that I would need to renormalize a field theory. There should be no difference there. Any differences that show up should show up due to counterterms that live on the initial time hypersurface. Okay, that I can modify, and those modifications should somehow involve this piece of the modification in the modes due to there being non-trivial boundary condition, non-trivial initial conditions on that hypersurface. So what we did is we looked at this sort of a simple description of an effective state with this structure function, and this is stuff that modifies things at short distance, which is where I would expect the Transplanckian physics to be. I mean, I could certainly modify things in the infrared as well if I felt like it, And there I would think of having, say, for example, excited states over the Bunch-Davies vacuum. That would be kind of the picture for that. So what happens? If you do loops, so for example, what we did is we computed the changes to the effective equation of motion for the inflaton. If you do loops, you do get new ultraviolet divergences. And they only show up, though. They only show up, so for example, I can actually use the time, the difference in the time between the actual time and the initial time as a regulator. And I only see the divergences when I'm exactly on the initial time hypersurfaces. These new divergences, the ones that will not be subtracted by bulk counterterms, are exactly the ones, live exactly in that initial time hypersurface. So therefore I can use counterterms that only live on that hypersurface as well. And the correspondence is that we found is that if you have UV structures in the initial state on the three-dimensional hypersurface, that corresponds to irrelevant operators that I have to put on that initial hypersurface. Whereas if I had modified things in the infrared, I would have found relevant and marginal operators involving, say, the extrinsic curvature and so forth that I could put on that initial hypersurface. And everything would be subtracted. Everything would be finite. And I could now compute corrections to the power spectrum in a completely controllable sort of way. And this is from an old one, so I have to... Let me just... All right. Bear with me. All right, so this is a more general... This is the... This is the ultraviolet piece. This is an infrared red one, and we write things in terms of the total frequency. And if you look at what the initial condition for the modes are, this would be the standard thing that you get from Bunch-Davies for the high K modes. But now there are corrections due to stuff in the infrared and stuff in the ultraviolet too that I didn't write down. And so, if I just take 5/4 and I look and I do these infrared modifications, the counterterms I need to put on the hypersurface are just these. Okay, dimension 3 counterterms. Whereas if I look at the ultraviolet ones, I have to put on these higher derivative type higher derivative and also using the extrinsic curvature. But once I do that, everything's fully well behaved. So Now we can compute. So let's compute. So if you use, say, an ultraviolet, sort of the leading order correction in the ultraviolet, you can actually compute the power spectrum, and it has this behavior, which is different from the Danielson behavior. As opposed to just having M over H is here and H over M is here, it has K dependence showing up, different K dependence than what Danielson had, depending on this sort of the CMB pivot scale over here. Okay, so here's a Danielson result, and they're different, and they're actually you could actually, you know, run CMB fast with these, and you would see differences in them. And this is completely, I can compute higher order corrections. Everything is reliable here, whereas opposed to here, I don't know what to do. I mean, there are no higher. Presumably, that is the whole model, and then I don't know what else to do. I don't know. I certainly don't know what physics is showing up in here.
Sorry, again, what is time-wise defined states? What does that
mean? Oh, this is the stuff coming in from nowhere. Yeah. So there's one last question. Let me see what time is it. Not close enough. There's one last question to address, and that's kind of one that got some airplay a while back. And that has to do with the stress energy tensor renormalization. And that's important if you want to actually see corrections to the evolution of the scale factor or what have you. And one of the questions that arose when people like Brian Green and Rich Easter and Will Kinney and Van der Schaar and Schaum also had their version of this effective initial state formalism. And the question that has to come up is, if I have these corrections to the initial state, could I have screwed things up so badly that, in fact, inflation never happens, that the back reaction of whatever I have done to to the initial state is so severe, creates so much new energy density, that inflation never actually occurs at all. And if you're doing it right, if you're really doing effective field theory, the whole point is that you can eat up all that large behavior into counter terms, and you're left with something calculable and small. Otherwise, you really haven't done it right. So there had been quite a fight over this, and so we decided to wade into the controversy because, you know, we had something to say, I think. And so here's this, the energy density and the pressure, and here are the standard pieces. I guess I'm starting to fade. And here are the pieces due to the new states, to the modifications of the states. And so what do? So you expand around FRW, and you look at the, so what we're going to do is you're actually going to compute we're going to look at the thing in the Hamiltonian that is linear in fluctuations in the metric. So here's a tadpole computed in the Stringer-Kelch formalism. These are the Whiteman functions for the graviton. And from this, we're going to extract the stress energy when we put in these new state corrections. So we put in a correction like this. We extract it out. We did, you know, you can dim reg things. And so these are the divergent pieces. And here's the bottom line. When you look at the finite pieces and you look at it compared to the vacuum energy, the figure of merit here is h squared m Planck squared, right? And when you look at what you get from these new contributions relative to h squared m Planck squared, you have h squared over m Planck squared suppression, and you have h over m whatever the new physics suppression is as well. It's all controlled. There is no back reaction that will not kick you out of inflation. And Parati and company were fighting with Green et al, and Green was, and all were arguing that, well, with the way they were doing it, inflation is just barely possible with their, and the back reaction just barely lets inflation happen. Parati said, no, you're just wrong. And the bottom line is that they were both wrong, we think, and that if you do it right, you actually get as much suppression as you need to make the back reaction be under control. So, near the end here, these are the prospects for what they can do for the fractional change in the power spectrum. So we're down to, you know, 10 to the minus 3 or so. The theoretical bound from cosmic variance is 10 to the minus 6. Okay? So these issues are going to come up. I mean, being able to calculate and understand how controlled your calculation is for the power spectrum and for other observables like the bispectrum, and people talk about the trispectrum, the four-point function, but that's not so clear. But at any rate, certainly for the power spectrum, these issues will come up. And we need to understand how to calculate properly and how to control these calculations. And this is certainly one way that we'll do that. And so to conclude, we need to be able to calculate. New physics could imprint itself. There could be some new physics. There are possible ways under certain adiabatic violation conditions and so forth where it's not outlandish that new physics could imprint itself on the CMB. It's going to be hard to extract, but it's doable. And what I hopefully shown for you today is that we have a way that can actually extract, can allow you to calculate things in a controllable, reliable sort of way, and back reactions under control, and we're just waiting for more data, as always. Thanks.
When you say back reaction, you mean just the tadpole diagram.
Right.
And you say this tadpole diagram is small, therefore you don't think setting sun diagrams and all these
All I'm really doing is I'm extracting it basically out to linear order in the fluctuation. What are the corrections to the stress energy because of these redefined modes? So that's the question I'm asking. So that's the back reaction I'm thinking about. If you wanted to think about the change from the Bunch-Davies as there being particles of Bunch-Davies in your state, the question is the energy density in those particles sufficiently large to prevent inflation from happening. And this is one way to access that question, by computing the corrections to the stress energy from them.
But it's with no self-interaction.
There's no self-interaction. Right, no matter self-interactions.
Could you just clarify what happens all these fluctuations when they go through reheating?
It's sort of then that becomes very model dependent. So there might be preheating. If there's preheating, that changes things. Once they go through reheating, there's some of the fluctuations won't have come back into the horizon while reheating is happening. In fact, all the ones we care about won't have.
Yeah, talking about the CMB, they're very far outside
right.
the horizon.
So I mean, if I was drawing pictures. So this is h to the minus 1. So during inflation, it would have been constant had I drawn a straight line. But here is the end of inflation. Say here is reheating. The fluctuations I care about are the ones that have come back in, say, during matter domination. Because that's when they can start moving the dark matter around to create the gravitational wells and so on. So reheating is happening over here. And the modes that do this, and there are some that do that, those get influenced, but that's not what I'm looking at. Thanks.
And this power spectrum is in multipolarity. So I'm not multipolarity.
Sure. Yeah.
Is there a specific reason why it should be diagonal in L and you cannot have off diagonal elements or?
Isogeny, yeah. I mean, it's PFK because you're looking at the two-point function, and there's just K and minus K, right? So then, you know, between the so there's only one vector that shows up there. There's only one wave vector.
Right. But if I could have fluctuations which are not in L, I can have some complications.
Sure, complications. But you're assuming isotropy.
But no, even with isotropy, I don't think there is a reason why there's, you know.
I think the power spectrum has to be diagonal in L because it's isotropic.
Yeah.
Well, if I have like this cup and I decompose it angular, right? I make an angular decomposition, I will have off diagonal elements.
Sure, but it's not isotropic.
No, but the space is isotropic because the fluctuation is not.
But I think I'm also assuming. I think that's part of what comes into the Gaussian, Gaussian fluctuations assumption that I'm only correlating. I'm only correlating k and minus k, and everything only depends on absolute value of k, and that gives me the diagonality in YLM space.
Put another way, you're just assuming that the unknown physics that produced these fluctuations is itself isotropic.
Yeah, right. But you don't have to, right? I mean, you could, people like, I guess, Mark Wise and collaborators at Caltech have been opening that up a little bit. So it's not, you don't have to, but, you know, it's hard enough as it is.
So at what time are you actually imposing your... When do you think your initial condition is?
Well, I mean, so tell me what scales you like on the microwave background sky. So WMAP would use, say, the 0.02 inverse megaparsec as your pivot scale. That's what we'd use, and then redshift back down. And if you call your new physics the Planck scale, that tells you what the time is, right?
So your initial data are these sort of coefficients in your expansion of F of K.
Right, right.
Those parameterize the departure from...
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really good to talk about this in language, sort of effective field theory language, because somehow it always seems to me that this trans-Planckian is a problem, so to speak, is sort of just quite a function of using the wrong coordinates, using co-moving momenta.
As opposed to,
If you looked at physical scales in real space, you'd never... As long as you didn't look at physical scales at any point, which is short.
Where's the short?
Should not see a problem.
Well,
whatever happens on the smaller.
Right. You're making the decoupling assumption, right? That I mean, things did happen on those short scales, but you're saying, yeah, let them. It never showed up on the CMB sky. which could well be the case. But it needs an, if that's the case, given the fact that you're stretching the scales, it needs an explanation.
With the, well, I'm not sure that you are stretching the scales in that sense. I mean, if that's a, you know, if you ask at any particular, I mean, I'm agreeing with you.
Okay.
At any particular time,
yeah.
Particularly the time at which you set your boundary conditions, you should be able to basically write everything down in terms of physics, which is,
oh sure.
Which
oh,
is
oh, absolutely.
Longer, much longer distances than the.
Absolutely. I mean, that was the point of choosing that particular time, right? Because, you know, if I move my time below that, then certainly in those coordinates, I would be accessing physics that I didn't know anything about, right? I mean, the whole point of choosing that earliest time, that is the earliest time at which I can start talking about things I know about. Anything earlier than that, I haven't got a clue, and that would access those, you know, short distance scales.
But in some sense, what we're seeing in the is we're measuring the operators at 300,000 years. We're never
right.
measuring them at 10 to the minus 43 seconds.
But you could imagine. So, but and I agree. Since you're agreeing with me, I will agree right back. But you could worry that there could have been some buildup of things that so that by 300,000 years, you've got this whole backlog of, you know, physics from the Planck scale till then. That's interfering with what you thought your fundamental physics was.
I agree that the correct way to parameterize it is H
right.
over N.
Right, then we're done.
but he's not parameterizing it at 300,000 years.
Right,
he's
parameterizing it at the initial time.
In the inflationary epoch.
Right.
Those scales are much, much smaller.
Yes, yeah. There's still no time do you ever have to talk about scales which are trans-Planckian.
Right.
They're called as the cis-Planckian.
Well, it depends on eight or not.
Well, but I mean, I pick eight or not, so that never happens, right?
But that just means you're going to start, you know, at six, so that we get eventually 65 e-foldings.
Right. I don't know. Right. And so, even if there's been other
e-foldings, gives 10,000. You're going to say you know nothing.
I know nothing about the right. The nine. You know, right.
10,000.
Yeah. Right.
What was the physics? You imposed some corrections. I saw a formula FK, but
oh, there is. There is just saying. FK has parts that grow in the ultraviolet and parts that decay, that shrink in the ultraviolet, and just parameterize it and just do a power Laurent expansion of that. So there could be physics in each one of those coefficients. So I didn't show it here, but in particular, if you pick one of the infrared, the sort of the leading infrared one, and you look at the corrections to gravity, that winds up showing up like a surface tension, okay, on the three-dimensional initial time hypersurface. So some of those coefficients could have standard issue physics names, so to speak, but other of them, mostly they're just ways to parameterize unknown physics.
So you don't want to say what the new physics is, which appears? No,
because I want you to tell me, I want you to come to me and say, I have a model of new physics, what can you tell me? And I'll say, okay, I will turn your model into this parameterization and then run it through my formalism. So that's sort of the generality of it. You give me whatever one of those models, whatever you have, I can turn it into something I can run through this formalism and get answers that I can believe in.
And do the string theorists think they can give that to you?
Oh, I don't know. You think? I don't know, Joe.
Sorry, I don't know.
Yeah.
What about people who believe in non-commutative fields?
Yeah, so those are the model builders, right? And so, but they're assuming everything is happening well past our regime of validity, right? So presumably we could actually take some of the things and calculate them and see how things correspond to coefficients.
I haven't worked in this, but since you asked, I always had the impression these oscillations would drop out in any kind of new physics that obeyed the adiabatic principle. They come from having some sharp momentum or time
right.
in which you impose the state. You know, you're creating real, a sine wave means you're creating real modes.
Right.
And if H over M is a small number, the adiabatic theorem would tell you that the expression is E, not just powers, but E to the minus
right.
M squared over H squared. And so this is why I find it hard, I just find it hard to understand how these oscillatory CMB spectra could really arise from
a fundamental. Yeah. I mean, I think ultimately, except for the fact that I mean, in systems that that are intrinsically time dependent, you could imagine having transients that are non-adiabatic, but that just happen to hit where your observation window is, right?
Just 65 e-foldings you can write.
665 plus or minus 10 or something like that. Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, if you have a lot of e-folds and you still want to play this game, it's a tough nut. There's probably no real physics that does that. Yeah, I definitely would agree with that.
Yeah, we've got to hope that the number of e-foldings is the
bare minimum, right?
We can see whatever it was that
you before, right? Yeah. What are the odds of that? I guess, you know, if they're a little bit more, we're just happy to be able to put some constraints on something, I suppose.
So one more technical point.
All right.
This issue about renormalizing boundary terms is not obviously, unambiguously, the correct thing to do, because we know of situations where you do get divergences, and it's just because for a curved surface, a curved boundary, for example. And those divergences are real. They have, mm-hmm. they're regulated only by a physical cutoff. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have a conductor, which is a curved surface, you mm-hmm. can get infinite boundary. You know, if you treat mm-hmm. them as Dirichlet boundary conditions
right.
at all modes, you will get divergences.
Right.
But that's because you've mistreated the boundary.
Right.
Okay, so it's not obvious you just take a divergence and then subtract it. That's not well, so you should have something like a smooth condition, I think, on the initial surface. Now maybe we can
argue
reparameterize in different ways, but
I mean I guess that
every time you see a divergence, it doesn't mean let's just subtract it.
Sure, but given the maybe it, just a rephrasing what you said, but they are all regulated by the time difference between the initial surface and whatever time things are happening at. And so
that's no good, right? Because you have a real divergence on the initial surface.
Right.
So,
but I mean, but
it means in some sense you're choosing non-adiabatic or very
well, I mean, that, I guess that's right. Right. So yeah. I think, that maybe it boils down to that as well. So if you wanted to somehow, if you knew some other physics that you, where you could do an adiabatic turn on to that state, presumably that would smear things out.
So what we basically advocated was just having adiabatic order for
right.
states, which is what you need to renormalize the stress tensor. And that, I actually don't know, we should talk about it. Does it give any different predictions? We looked at all those models in that framework, and it seems to make perfect sense.
So I think we actually checked that. In the case where, if we choose our F case to correspond to what would be adiabatic order 4 or higher, we do the same thing.
Yeah. But if they're not,
we get a different answer. And I think, and it probably has to do, we are saying that there is this initial time, and we're not saying anything about the buildup of the state to that initial time, which is what you guys are really talking about with your.
No, we're just saying as an initial value problem, the same way we discuss initial value problems in other contexts in this workshop, there's a restriction on the initial data. You cannot take arbitrarily sharp ultraviolet, you know, sensitive modes there, or else you will just produce new divergences that you don't really understand. But you know,
yeah,
it might be a small difference, but in practice.
But as a principle question, there's a new principle.
It's a little bit strange just to bodily subtract, you know, put in a sharp initial data which has ultraviolet sensitivity and then subtract it. You don't necessarily know that's the right prescription. It's changing the theory because you're introducing new kinds of counterterms.
Right, and if those counterterms had support somewhere above, away from that initial time hypersurface, I'd be exceedingly concerned because it would run into the whole issue that your subtraction prescription is now totally state dependent, sort of away from where you should know about the initial state. Given that they are forced to live on that initial time hypersurface, it doesn't answer your question fully, but I'm a little less worried about the issue. I mean, you know, okay. But it's a gut feeling.
I can show you where the examples,
okay.
experimentally measured things mm-hmm. with Casimir's surface.
Casimir's, where
that's not the
when you start digging thing. Into the conductor,
right.
And so on. But, yeah. Okay. I guess we're good.
Thank you.